Welcome to Athens Happens. I'm Ben Peters, managing editor at The New Political. Athens Happens is a weekly news podcast brought to you by reporters at TNP who are dedicated to explaining the nuances of Athens and state politics. You can find new episodes every Friday at thenewpolitical.com, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, YouTube, SoundCloud, or wherever else podcasts can be downloaded. This week, I sat down with Joel Newby, a Democratic candidate for Ohio's 15th congressional district, who spoke about his plans to advocate for pragmatism rather than idealism concerning electability and policies like healthcare, a Green New Deal, and broadband expansion. Full disclosure, Newby is a former communications director for The New Political. Hello, I am here with Joel Newby, a Democrat running for Congress in Ohio's 15th congressional district, challenging incumbent Republican Steve Stivers. We are here on Saturday, February 22nd, in the Schoonover Center podcast studio. This was originally going to be a forum with both Newby and his opponent, Daniel Kilgore, but we got an email last night, late in the evening. Kilgore canceled because of prior work commitments. So instead, we're just going to interview Joel. Joel, is that okay if I call you Joel, Mr.
Yeah.
Newby?
No, okay. Joel. Okay. Like, the only time that I would expect that to change is put representative, right? But other than that, no. First name is the best, I think.
Okay, sounds good. So we're just going to interview you, and we're asking you the same questions we were going to ask both of you. We retooled them a little bit just to account for the fact that there's only one person now. But I wanted to start asking you, guys at the forum in Athens about 2 weeks ago spoke a lot about electability, and I want to know what electability means to you.
Yeah, thanks. And thanks for having me on this podcast. I think that, and as you guys typically do, full disclosure, I was formerly with New Political, my time here at OU. I think electability is the conversation that needs to happen in these gerrymandered districts. I don't think that there's enough conversation about it because, you know, Troy Barterson, his district is R plus seven, Steve Stivers' district, R plus seven, Jim Jordan, R plus 14. And what those numbers mean is you take what the past presidential race was and then you add that plus number, and then that's how much they think that you'll win by, essentially. I think that it's an important conversation to have, because why talk about what we can do in office if you're never going to make it there? And for me, the electability argument comes in that I'm actually from this district. Like to say that this district built me, because it's true. If it wasn't for my time in Pickaway County, and you know that's one of the reddest counties in this state, if it wasn't for my time down here at OU, one of the bluest counties in the state, I wouldn't be the person that I am. I would not have the ideas. I would not have the capacity to do this. So I think that representation and electability really means coming of the people, then going to Washington, D.C. and actually advocating for those people.
I'm curious, what experiences here do you think that you had that shaped you?
So I think one of the I would be remiss if I didn't say all of my student government time, because people like to laugh while you're here on campus, oh, it's just student government, it's nothing big, but it does teach you a lot. It teaches you how to interact with your constituents, how to work with other people, how to work with an administration that can be extremely hard to move. It teaches you a lot about how large institutions work. Like if I would go to Congress, Congress is its own institution, and how we can move that institution to a place that helps our causes is an important thing to know. And that's exactly what you do here in student government. I would advocate for more people here at OU getting involved in student government in some way, shape, or form, because it's a great opportunity to learn how to move institutions and learn how to properly interact with an institution that's very difficult to move. And then when you're done here, you can go and start moving the corporation you go to work for, the small business you go to work for, you know, the government that you want to help lead in. It's a great opportunity. So definitely there. and just the people. Like, OU is a big university, but it has a small town feeling of like 50 people, right?
Mm-hmm.
I used to get made fun of from my friends that we would walk down the street, we'd stop and I'd talk to somebody that I knew, and then you walk five more feet and then there's somebody else and then somebody else and somebody else. But I feel like that's the way it is for everybody around here, and that's a good thing. You learn how to interact with people of different ideas. I graduated from high school with, from K through 12, I think I went to school with like maybe two people of color. So when I came down here, and people from Cleveland will kind of laugh at this notion, and they should, but I came down here and I was like, oh my God, look how diverse it is down mm-hmm. here. And it wasn't until you make more friends and you realize, this is a very white school as well, but the opportunity to interact with people of different races, different religions, different nationalities, different everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a great way to start learning different problems and different issues that affect different people differently, and how to come from a different angle, and how to view the world in not just your perspective, but 100 different perspectives. This university and the time that you spend down here could really, really be a life-changing experience.
Great. Yeah. So, and I'm curious, why in this particular election do you think electability is so important?
I think that you have to look back at the previous elections, right?
Mm-hmm.
So at the time he was law director, Pat Lang ran. And that was like he was an Athens guy. So reaching out to the rest of the district, I think, in my opinion, was a little bit more difficult for them than what he expected.
Mm-hmm.
Then you had Scott Warden. He ran twice, and he was the middle of the district, essentially. And then you had Rick Neal in the last election, very strong in Franklin County, but he reaching out to the other counties was really difficult for him. And I have that experience all through the district. What I'm looking at is we've had four elections. None of the Democratic candidates have gotten above 40%. And I think that it shows the realist in me that, listen, what is it going to take to get 50%?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that you need 50% because there is a Libertarian candidate out there.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say 50% plus one, that's what it would take to get the W, right? And I think that is the way that I look at this district. When other people wanted to run solely on their values, I think electability has to play in this one. I do think that the presidential race like kind of plays a little bit of a role. So it's front of mind for everybody. A lot of the questions I get is, what makes you think that you can win and run?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that brings it up as well. When I did the new political article, when I first announced, yeah, that was one of the questions up front. What makes you think you can win? No other Democrat can. And then gerrymandering is obviously at the forefront of our minds. And what does it take to overcome gerrymandering is essentially what every single election in a gerrymandered district should be about.
Mm-hmm.
What will it take to overcome this gerrymandering?
Okay. So do you view yourself, I want to back up. I think that through talking with both you and your opponent and listening to you both speak at the hard time, we've had a really hard time trying to pinpoint, not saying this is a good thing or a bad thing, but trying to differentiate you both, trying to find some sort of ideological agreement or disagreement. And I'm curious, do you view yourself as a moderate or a progressive? And what do these labels mean to you?
To be honest with you, neither.
Okay.
I guess if I have to go out there and so other people can understand where I'm coming from, I'll call myself progressive, but I'm a Democrat.
Okay.
And you know, I am for a single payer system. So I'm not, you know, Joe Manchin Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
Probably more Sharon Brown Democrat kind of deal.
Mm-hmm.
But I want people to understand this. When you say that you can't really see the ideological differences, because you're going past what's actually being said and getting to where our platform stances are.
Mm-hmm.
Winning in this district is about how you say it, not so much what you say, but how you say it, how you go back and talk about why you're for something. So I think my opponent will come out here and say that, you know, a single payer healthcare system is the right way to go. Medicare for all is the right way to go because it's the right thing to cover as many people as possible in this district. And as much as I will say that too, I'll come on the back end and also put out a jobs argument because it is a jobs argument. By eliminating that, small businesses can grow more. You don't have to worry about staying at your job in order to keep your healthcare system or anything like that. So the way that I always frame it is, how do I get my Republican uncle to vote for me? And how do I get them to believe in my progressive values? And that's where the conversation actually is taking place. It's one thing to say that you're going to stand for progressive value, but it's a completely another thing to go out there and sell it.
Okay.
And you have to not only sell it, but get people to not just buy it, buy in. You want them to buy into the program. And that is something that I think is a place to look at when you're talking about this primary race, is look at how we're able to communicate the ideas in which we're advocating for, because that is what we have to take to the independents and Republicans. The progressives are going to see us and say, okay, you both stand for something. How do I actually get to that single payer program? How do I get this infrastructure plan? How do I build my life based on your platform? And it's the communication that's necessary.
What do you think is the most effective way to sell it?
I think it's meeting people where they're at.
Okay.
Right? I think that it's wrong to expect everybody to share your same value system. So why would I meet you at a value system where it's different for you than it is for me? Well, I'll meet you at the same goals. And our same goals might be that you want to cover everybody in healthcare, but you also want to grow the economy. You're afraid of, you know, the scary term socialism.
Mm-hmm.
When a single payer system, if you want to go to the political science definition, is socialism. But when it comes to the broad economy, it's a single payer system is going to grow capitalism better. And that's something that I can communicate on. And it's the goal of expanding capitalism in order to have more jobs, to keep raising wages. And that's a goal that I can agree with Republicans and independents on. And that's where I meet them on all my value system, is that if I can't come to them and say, hey, we can meet the same goal by going my way, then I have to reevaluate my value system. Then.
Okay. So since we're touching on the topic of healthcare, you said that you want to make incremental changes to Obamacare rather than jumping straight to a Medicare for all system. Is that accurate?
So let me fix that, right?
Yeah, go for it.
What I'm advocating for is, it took I wrote my master's paper on actually moving Obamacare into law. So it was the rules and procedures of Congress and how it affected the Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm.
What I realized was Barack Obama was elected in 2008. We didn't actually get that passed until the mid of 2010, essentially, right? Let's just use generics. That took a lot of time. And that was a very small step, really, in the grand scheme of getting people insured. I know that going to a single payer system is going to take more time. Well, I'm worried about that if it takes more than 2 years, maybe I'm not in office after that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I want to make sure that we nail down things that are part of Obamacare that we all agree on. So that way, when, you know, if I get kicked out of office or something along those lines, right, that at least we have Obamacare locked down. So we're not waiting for John McCain, because he's no longer there, to go and put the thumbs down in order to save healthcare for our citizens. But just because I'm advocating for that doesn't mean that at the same time, I'm not going to be pushing for a single payer.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that the negotiations to get to a single payer and what that system would look like, it's going to take some time. But that doesn't mean in the meantime we can pass some bills to lock down the pieces of Obamacare, so that way if we don't succeed in our goal in the end, we still have a great healthcare system, or at least moving to a better healthcare system, and we don't have to worry about, you know, a Donald Trump coming in and trying to remove what the progress that we've made.
This sounds like a very pragmatic approach.
Yeah, and it comes from my experience in knowing the rules of Congress that it's going to take time. And a lot of my ideas come from that. And working with other people takes time. I hope to be able to unite some people, especially with my country background. I can go to Washington, D.C., sit down with a few Republicans, you know, pull up a six-pack of beer, talk about what our actual goals are, how do we get to those goals together, and start writing some bills to get there. And that would be my approach to actually getting something done.
So how do you convince Democrats who maybe aren't in favor of such a pragmatic approach, who are maybe a little bit more idealistic, that your plan is the right one?
Look at the grand scheme. I'm moving towards that single-payer system. We also have to bring, you know, there's 43% of Americans that are going to vote for Donald Trump, you know, regardless what he does. Mm-hmm. Maybe more like 40. But still, that's a large portion of the country that we have to convince to get on our side in order to get the votes in the Senate. That's what it really comes down to. We have to get the votes in the Senate to put this in place. We have to get the votes in the House to get it in place. And then we have to be able to defend the presidency after doing that, so that way we can continue to keep that in place without having another Donald Trump coming in and just yanking it from under us.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I would argue. If we want a single-payer system that will last long-term, then we need to look at it from a more pragmatic approach instead of just saying, this is what I want and it's the only way I'm going to go. We need to work progressively towards that, and aggressively towards that as well.
So I know that there are, I mean, a lot of Democrats in Congress, let alone Republicans, who aren't very keen on a single-payer system. And I'm curious, how would you work with them to convince members of your own party that this is the right direction to go in, let alone members of the opposing party?
Yeah, I think this is actually more of a electoral issue.
Mm-hmm.
I think that my it's not so much convincing the members of Congress, it's convincing the American public, and that's doable. They were swindled with Newt Gingrich coming in, and when he came in the 80s and started telling people that the Democrats just want to feed you socialism, 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 that's when we started losing on some of these more social agenda programs, right? But when we look at the history of the United States, the most popular programs that we have, Social Security, Medicare, all very popular, but they were not popular when they first got in. Mm-hmm. So really, I'm going to convince the American public that not only is it going to save more lives, but it's going to give you more jobs. It's going to increase the economy in the long end. That's who I'm talking to. Members of Congress will be dragged kicking and screaming by their voters, not by me.
I do you think that that is a bit naive to believe that members are so responsive to their constituency?
They're responsive to their whatever gets them in office, not their whole. I think that it would be naive to believe that their whole constituency, like say Rob Portman, right?
Mm-hmm.
We like to protest against Rob Portman in Columbus a lot, but the problem is that he's banking on just getting 51% of the vote. That's all he needs to stay in office mm-hmm. in Ohio, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's really just speaking to that 51%. With my ability to speak across the aisle to independents and Republicans, that's who I'm going to convince that this is good for jobs. And then those voters will start changing the minds of those other representatives. And we have to do that. We can't just implement a program that 50% of the nation believes in and then just expect it to live on forever.
Mm-hmm.
That just won't work. Look at how much they've already gutted Obamacare. Look at how much they've gutted even Social Security while Newt Gingrich took over. So when I look at something like that, it's not being naive. It's I'm going to talk to the people that actually give them their jobs.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you how then, because, I mean, there are plenty of elected, or I'm sorry, plenty of Republican constituents who are never going to support something like a Medicare for all. How are you going to get that 50% onto your side so that it's not just a, you know, a polarized, I'm not speaking.
Well, I think the goal. Yeah, I think the goal is to get to 70%, okay. Not to 100 necessarily, because a lot of people won't allow you to get there. But to get to 70, 75, 80%, somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, especially in this in political environment, we think too much in red and blue.
Mm-hmm.
We forget that the vast majority of America is actually purple, and it's actually a dark purple, more blue than red. So I don't think that it would actually take a lot of work, but you got to talk to where they're at, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's a great thing to go out there and say, yeah, we want to cover these people that are, you know, falling victim to healthcare and not being able to pay their debts and stuff like that. But a lot of Americans are wondering, well, I pay my debts. I pay my health insurance. I do this. I do that. The better argument is, hey, when your work changes your health insurance plan that you're not even part of that decision, so you can remove that from your mind.
Mm-hmm.
When your work changes that plan, that changes the doctors that you can actually go to. So I'm more interested in passing a program that allow you to keep your doctors. I think Barack Obama thought that that's the direction that he was going to be able to go, but because you buy into the private sector so much under Obamacare, that those private sector insurance companies, they're changing your hospitals that you can go to, your in-network hospitals all the time. I'm more concerned with, hey, if we have one insurance company, the United States government,
mm-hmm.
you could go to a hospital here in Athens, or you could go to one in Columbus, or some random hospital in Georgia. It doesn't matter. It's still covered in your network because there's only one network. And that's the conversation that needs to happen. It needs to happen. Another conversation that needs to happen is about the jobs. You don't have to worry about staying at your job in order to keep your health insurance. Well, that's going to increase the market competitiveness between jobs because they can't just throw healthcare out there. They have to worry about what the working environment's going to be like, what the pay is. They're going to have to worry about what kind of retirement benefits that you get. There's so many other things that they have to entice you with to keep you there at that point.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be, I honestly think, and the numbers that I've seen back this up, going to a single payer healthcare system will be a large expense for the government up front, but in the long end, it will build far more economic opportunities in this country than what we ever could under a private healthcare system.
So I know that at the forum that you were at in Athens with Mr. Kilgore 2 weeks ago, they asked you a question, who are you supporting for president? And I don't want to say you endorsed Warren, because I don't think that's fair, but you did say that you were ostensibly planning to vote for her.
Yeah.
And I'm curious why her as opposed to any of the other candidates.
Yeah, so this is not an endorsement at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think that whoever, you know, follow me on Twitter or Facebook or even through this podcast, they can make up their own mind on who they want to vote for.
Mm-hmm.
For me, Warren gets me excited. She makes me believe that there's hope tomorrow. And that's something I haven't felt since 2012 when Barack Obama was running, or any time that I really hear Barack Obama speak, is that every one of her speeches you have to talk about Donald Trump, but too many of the other candidates, all they want to do is look how negative and just disastrous the current administration is. It is. But I don't want to hear about that from my president. I want to hear about hope. I want to hear what tomorrow is going to look like. And you'll see that in my congressional campaign as well. I don't speak about how Steve Stivers is not going to do something a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I try to focus in on, give me a shot and I'll bring these infrastructure programs in. I will advocate for a single payer system. I will, you know, we have economic future here in District 15 that we can advocate for. That's not being done right now. And I hope that that hope is coming out in my campaign, because it's definitely coming out in hers. And that's what inspires me. I want to be inspired. Nobody wants to vote for somebody that makes them dreadful.
Mm-hmm.
They want to be inspired. They want to know that the place that they're raising their kids, the place that that they want to start that family, where they want to walk down the streets and enjoy and take in the scenery, that's going to be a better place tomorrow, not a worse place. Mm. And I see a lot of hope coming from her. And I, you know, as somebody that's gone to law school, when and somebody that I like to establish my own plan just the way that Elizabeth Warren does, those two things really draw me in.
Mm-hmm.
I love listening to her talk about like the law and politics, not just politics.
Interesting. Yeah. So, I mean, more so earlier in the campaign than now, both she and Sanders were very similar candidates. She has kind of diverged from him on a lot of things in recent months. I'm curious, why does she excite you more than somebody like Bernie Sanders?
I don't like, it seems like every time that he has to bring something up, what he says is true,
mm-hmm.
but how he says it is a reflection on how grim it is for the middle and lower class in economics in this country.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like the focus on that. I also would disagree with you on how close they were in the beginning, because Elizabeth Warren is a capitalist, mm-hmm. like solely a capitalist. She's a lot like me, where the capitalist market is the sole thing that brought millions of people out of poverty in the 20th century. The only problem is that you have to be able to regulate it. Mm-hmm. If you go buy a lawnmower at Lowe's, there's a thing on it called a governor, so that way you don't just, you know, drive it into your neighbor's fence, essentially. And that's what you need for capitalism. You do need to pull it back a little bit. You need to put reins on a horse in order to control it to make sure that it does what you need it to do. And that's the way to look at the capitalist market, is that throw a few reins on it so that way you can pull it back when it's getting out of control, or you can actually unleash it when you need it to be unleashed. I don't think Bernie has that same opinion. I don't think that he's not a communist, but mm-hmm. at the same time, he's further away from respecting the capitalist market than what Elizabeth Warren is, for sure.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah. I wanted to ask you, how are you financing your campaign, and how are you thinking about that as you're going on the trail?
I'm reaching out to a bunch of small donors.
Hmm.
The problem with financing a campaign is people want to get involved, but they financially can't, right? So as much as I do need money to print the lit and to be able to get the information that I need out,
mm-hmm.
yeah, I do need money for that, but I would like to focus more on the volunteer hours. We need to knock some doors. TV commercials aren't going to change minds.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be knocking some doors. And so that's where the focus of my campaign is. So I need volunteers more than anything else. I am hiring a bunch of interns in order to not only participate in door knocking, but also learn the backside of a campaign. I know when I interned on a few campaigns, I thought I was getting hired on to, you know, help out with the back end work, and then it just turned into a bunch of door knocking.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not interested in that. Yeah, you do have to do some door knocking for my campaign if you're an intern, but for the most part, you focus on the back end stuff, writing some policy, writing some speeches, that kind of stuff. I fundraise a lot through computers or doing an email blast, or, you know, just like you would see Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders do. Maybe making a few phone calls to like other donors to let them know that I exist and that my campaign is an option for them to donate to. But when it comes to actual resources that I need, it's that volunteer time. No amount of money in the world is going to buy you a dedicated volunteer.
Mm-hmm. Are you taking PAC money?
No.
Is there a reason for that?
I don't. My thing is that when somebody donates to your campaign, they're not just financially supporting your campaign. They're also, that's a guaranteed vote. So if I get a bunch of independents or Republicans to give me $5, I got their vote too.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I'm concerned. PAC money, there's no real obligation behind the PAC to stick with you. They're also looking out for their own interest, right? You know, there are some progressive, they're not necessarily called PACs, but they act like a PAC, and they fund progressive candidates, and I refuse to take it from them too. I don't want that kind of influence in the campaign. Not that I would be influenced, but it's what other people see, mm-hmm. right? Because you have to disclose who donates to the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
If they want to get involved, then they can get involved on their own time, and they're looking out for their own interests at that point. They're not looking out for newbie for Congress interests. That's why I wouldn't apply for like an R Revolution endorsement or something along those lines. Because even though it's not labeled as a PAC, it acts as a PAC. There are some watchdog groups that actually consider R Revolution as a super PAC. It's just not filed with the FEC that way. Mm. Why would I want to get that endorsement if they're not, they're going to be looking out for R Revolution's interest, not newbie for Congress. So I'm more dedicated to the people that want to get involved because they want to see broadband internet in their small town. They want to see a single payer healthcare system. They want to see some real changes so we can get proper care for the elders in our community. So I want to talk to those people more than a PAC.
One of the big problems, and you spoke about this in the past, is facing this region in particular, is the lack of broadband access.
Yeah.
And I'm curious what specific steps you would work toward in office to actually try to alleviate that. Because I mean, this is a bipartisan issue. There are already members on both sides of the aisle working to.
They're not working nearly where they need to.
Hmm.
Instead, they want to fill their donors' coffers, especially Stivers. He'll come out and say this right now that he's for broadband internet for everybody, but. You're not even on the right committee to bring that to people.
Mm.
So what are you actually talking about? Get out of here. That's just a talking point because you want votes from these small towns. What I would do is exactly what we did with the highway system. Fund a large infrastructure program throughout the state. Focus a lot on Appalachia, Ohio, especially since it's been left behind. And basically give the money to put the lines in the ground. We can talk about making them a public utility later, and that's going to be a more difficult conversation that I would love to be part of and I would advocate for, but let's just get the lines in the ground because the biggest thing right now is that the private companies don't want to run these lines because there's no profit at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you run something where in the net you're going to lose money than gain money as a private company? That's just bad business. So government is there to make up for those deficits. And this is one area where every single road needs to have a utility truck planting this wire on. And that's what I would advocate for is the funding in order to do that, get them out there in a massive workforce. I mean, in the end, this is a giant jobs program as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
The installing and maintaining of this equipment. Let's get these massive armies out there. We could have this done in maybe one or at most two terms. We just don't have the political will to do it. Steve Stiver has been in office since 2011, January 2011. If he really wanted to do something about it, he could have done it. He hasn't.
Hmm. Do you support a Green New Deal?
Yes, but I would like to make sure that everybody understands what Green New Deal actually is, yeah. You know? Really, it's just the Green New Deal is I want these goal to be our goals.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even, there's not a lot of practical ways of going forward. So whenever you hear somebody saying, I support a Green New Deal, mm-hmm. the follow-up question has to be, okay, how are you going to get it done?
Yeah.
Because the Green New Deal is just a lot of, I want this goal to be in place. I want this goal to be in place. There's not a lot of back end of, okay, how are you going to do it? I think that's where me and my primary opponent really separate is that he ends his conversation with, I support the Green New Deal. I don't talk about the Green New Deal, not because I don't support it, but because I want to talk about actual solutions to get to the goals that Green New Deal is talking about. If we're creating an argument between Republicans and Democrats over the Green New Deal, we're going to go nowhere. Because at the end, even if we would win that argument, all we've done is establish goals. I would like to actually put in place either some sort of tax incentive or maybe government funding in order to get windmills and solar plants and or solar farms and solar the factories to build these things here in District 15. That's where I'm focused. I'm focused on if we can build a clean energy economy here in District 15 that will help us build more jobs. Mm-hmm. That's where my focus is. So I will tell you, yeah, I support the ideas behind the Green New Deal, mm-hmm. but they're just ideas and goals. Mm-hmm. I'm worried about the practical implementation. I'm worried about practically putting these things into place where we can actually get to those goals without even having to set the goals. Because if we're just fighting over the goals, we're never going to get there. So instead of fighting over the goals, how about we fight over the jobs and the lives it will save by putting it in now, right? Mm. I think, especially when we're down here in Athens, we got to talk about drinking water a lot. Drinking water is very important, but it's being polluted through either like a fracking source or the old coal mines that the companies aren't taking care of, which is technically illegal, but nobody's prosecuting him for him. Mm-hmm. But you see this orange sludge just coming right out of the old mines and polluting our waters. So we can't go fish in it. We can't drink the water. And I'm more concerned about getting people in there to fix these problems than arguing over a goal that people are automatically divided over. Mm. I also think that the rollout was kind of botched. I mean, they were jokingly putting in their press release when they released the Green New Deal. Mm-hmm. They talked about that it would take a lot of time, which is true. Like, it would take time to get some of this implemented, and what that time frame looks like, not a lot of people understand right now. But they made the joke about, we can't control how often cows fart or how many times you travel on a plane, right? Mm-hmm. And it was purely to be a joking point. But Republicans capitalized on it and said, hey, they want to take away your hamburgers and airplanes. And that's, you know, they botched the opening, and now the Green New Deal has been tainted. And now we're arguing over something that doesn't really have a practical application. I want to argue about the practical application of these things.
Awesome. I think that's all the questions I have for you. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we head out?
I want to focus in on not just for this primary, mm-hmm. but going forward in the general, if I'm lucky enough to come out of this primary, right? Mm-hmm. I want to focus in on one thing. It's rebuilding these small towns that are all through District 15. We don't really have large cities in this district outside of Columbus area, right? Once you leave Franklin County, the majority of the cities are pretty small. And we need to worry about those issues affecting those small communities. I do have very progressive stances when it comes to a lot of issues that Democrats care about a lot. Mm-hmm. But we really need to start worrying about what's going on in the daily lives of those small town people. These are our hometowns, right? And they're being just gutted, essentially. Businesses are leaving. Young people like us are leaving because who wants to live in a town that's essentially dying, right? And so we're moving to bigger and bigger towns. And that's not sustainable. We need to worry about what the economy of these small towns look like and start getting them hooked up to the global economy. Because as much as we sometimes hate globalization, that's where the market is now. It's a global economy. We need to work on 21st century technologies and infrastructure in order to get them hooked up. And I think that is a conversation that needs to happen more often. It's a place that Steve Stivers has left us behind. I don't think my primary opponent is focused enough on these small towns. And I also want to highlight this. If it seems like I'm being highly, you know, I'm on offense a lot or I'm being aggressive, it's mm-hmm. because, you know, Steve Stivers has left my hometown behind
mm-hmm.
and then ran over to the banking committee, which there's no bank headquarters in District 15, really. He ran over to the banking committee, and that's where his focus is on banks. Well, how about you go over to the ag committee and worry about farmers? How about you go over to any other committee, really, right?
Mm-hmm.
And be able to work on these small town issues. And he doesn't care about that. He cares about banks. So I am being aggressive because when your hometown's being hurt, when your family and friends and neighbors are hurt, that's when you get mad, and that's when it's time to start replacing the guy that's making those decisions.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate you coming on.
No, thank you for having me. I greatly appreciate it.
Sure thing.
And that wraps it up here on Athens Happens. Make sure to tune in every Friday for new episodes that shed light on the politics that impact all of our lives. Remember, you can find the show on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and on YouTube in a video podcast format. Don't forget to leave us ratings and reviews. Also, be sure to check out our website at thenewpolitical.com, where we regularly report stories on what really happens here in Athens, and follow at The New Political on social media. Thanks, guys. Have a great weekend.
Ugh.
What's wrong, Alec?
These census people won't stop reaching out. I don't want to fill out the census. Leave me alone.
Why not? Filling out the census helps college students like us receive Pell Grants, which helps us afford schooling. With just 12 simple questions that take 10 minutes, taking the census is easy.
But how will the census help me after I graduate?
The 2020 census will help other Bobcats like you and I for the next 10 years.
I guess you're right. Taking the census will for sure help me and my community. I'm going to take the census on April 1st.
Bobcats, get on the map.
This app was brought to you by the Scripps Public Relations Student Society of America.